This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Just ahead, we hear what's in store for the 57th annual Beaufort Old Homes and Gardens Tour and Antique Show and Sale next weekend. With summer less than a week away, local officials and emergency personnel are reminding folks that the beach, if not respected, can be a dangerous place. Rip currents have been in the headlines this week after a drowning on Emerald Isle last Saturday. Two teenagers from Wayne County were swimming near the Bougainlet Pier Saturday evening when they were swept out to sea.
The original call came in to us at 6:08 p.m. That's when rescue units were dispatched to the scene for two swimmers in the water in distress.
Emerald Isle Police Chief Tony Reese says a surfer quickly assisted 16-year-old Tyrese Worsley to shore.
He was in distress. The people on the pier were shouting at one of the surfers and directed him to the individual. He was able to get the individual onto a surfboard until the rescue crews could get out on the jet ski and bring him in. And then CPR was started on the beach, and he was transported to Carteret General and then airlifted to Vidon Medical Center.
His friend, 17-year-old Elijah Hennett, went missing. U.S. Coast Guard, along with Emerald Isle Police, Fire, and EMS, conducted a 25-hour search of about 129 square nautical miles before it was called off. On Monday, a dive team from Atlantic Beach was called in to check the waters where Hennett was last seen. A day later, a call came in to Emerald Isle Police.
We received a call from an individual staying in the 7700 block that they observed something, an unidentified object, floating, bobbing in the water. And so we went out and sent rescue swimmers out who were able to identify it as the body of the 17-year-old missing swimmer that we had, Mr. Hennett. Our recovery team was able to go out and recover the body and bring it in.
The other teen, Tyrese Worsley, remains at Vidon Medical Center in Greenville in serious condition.
It's a tragic situation. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the family of both young men as they go through the recovery and the mourning of their loss.
This is the first ripcurrent death of the season along the Crystal Coast, although more than 50 rescues have taken place already this summer. This week alone, there were 25 rescues in Emerald Isle, despite warnings from the National Weather Service of a moderate threat of rip currents. Atlantic Beach is another tourist spot that's dealing with an increase in rescues this season. Fire Chief for Atlantic Beach Fire Department Adam Snyder says there's been 14 in the past few weeks.
They've done some dredging. That pumping of sand stopped right at the edge of the circle where the lifeguards are at. So we are experiencing extremely strong rips right at our swimming area.
Snyder says the town has 4.8 miles of coastline, but only 850 feet are protected by lifeguards. The fire department responds to calls that come in from the rest of the beach.
So what we do, pretty much the lifeguards do in the morning time, they look and they actually get inside the rip currents, see how hard they're pulling, see if it's, if the water's safe for that day. So they're really evaluating the surf conditions and rip currents and so forth to make sure that they're advising the patrons of where the best areas to swim.
If a strong rip current is confirmed, Snyder says lifeguards will post red flags in that area and prevent people from swimming. They also have a system using color-coded flags to let beachgoers know the rip current risk for that day.
So a green flag, if they're flying green flag, that means it's good swimming. A yellow flag means use cautious caution. Rip currents are present. And when we fly a red flag, we recommend people not to swim at all. We can't force people not to swim, but at least we can make them aware that we're not recommending them to swim.
Rip currents form when there's a break in a sandbar and water is funneled out to sea. They may be sudden and unexpected, so lifeguards are constantly on the lookout, watching for gaps between the waves, a channel of churning, choppy water, and different colored water.
A lot of times it'll be between tide changes, so where the rip currents could be pulling a lot stronger than other times. You also have to consider of wave conditions. So if there's no wind and there's no waves, rip currents are going to be very slim to none. When the surf is building and there's lots of waves, which the waves are created by wind, at that point in time is when you're really going to have strong rip currents.
During summer seasons with high wind and surf, Snyder says lifeguards and the fire department can take part in upwards of 200 rip current rescues.
Though other summer seasons, we don't have hardly any wind, any surf, so it'd be a very calm summer. and we would do none. So it's all depending on what Mother Nature is doing.
Since long-range rip current predictions aren't possible, we'll have to see what the season has in store. Snyder has noticed it has been windier than normal. That may be a contributing factor to the drowning in Emerald Isle, along with two rip current rescues at Fort Macon last Saturday.
They got kind of pulled out in the currents and right in front of our guards, fortunately, and our guards were able to go get them and get them back in safely.
Park Superintendent at Fort Macon State Park, Randy Newman, says he doesn't have an exact number of rescues they've done this season. He says if a rip current is spotted, lifeguards are posted in that area to make sure people don't swim.
Well, we have about a mile and a half of oceanfront beach, but we only allow our lifeguards are only in about a 100 yards area. We concentrate that way. You know, we tell everybody we have a protected swimming area. And so our guards are constantly whistling people in. We really try to prevent from having, rescues.
Similar to Atlantic Beach and Emerald Isle, Fort Macon uses flags to alert beachgoers to the rip current threat, except Newman says they never fly the green flag.
There's always rip currents every day. So we usually fly yellow flags just to be cautious, when you're in the water. So it's always a threat. That's just part of the beach habitat with the waves and sandbars.
Last year, Fort Macon State Park reported record visitation of 18.8 million people, many coming to spend a day at the beach. Likewise, Atlantic Beach experiences a population boom, going from about 1,800 year-round residents to 35,000 during the summer months. Anytime that more people are in the water, there's the potential that the number of rip current rescues will go up. That's why Atlantic Beach Fire Chief Snyder is trying to get the message out to folks on how to break the grip of the rip.
If you find yourself in a rip current and you're being pulled away from the beach, the biggest thing is to remain calm, do not panic, and swim parallel to shore. Again, rip currents are mostly formed between two sandbars. So if you swim parallel to shore, there's a good likelihood it could be only 20 feet, sometimes 10 feet, sometimes 50 feet. If you swim parallel, you'll actually get up on top of the sandbar, and you might be able to stand up.
It's also a good idea to bring a flotation device when you go in the water. Life jackets for the kids, but for you, something like a boogie board, an inner tube.
Even be one of those pool noodles. One of those pool noodles can save your life. At least if you find yourself in a rip current, you can at least keep yourself afloat. And then the fire department can be called and they can come out there and get you.
Another way to minimize your risk of being swept away in a rip current, don't go in water that's deeper than waist high, especially if you're not a strong swimmer.
People just don't drown because of rip currents. We've had people on perfect days that are just non-swimmers that get out on sandbars and step off of the back of the sandbar and drown. So the biggest thing is if you're coming down to the beach and you are not a good swimmer, is to stay in shallow water.
There are so many miles of coastline that there's no way to post lifeguards at every beach. That's why Snyder urges people to swim in a protected area. Every year, lifeguards rescue tens of thousands of people caught in rip currents across the United States, but according to the National Weather Service, an estimated 100 people are killed annually. Here locally, towns don't always keep track of rip current rescues, so it's hard to say what the numbers are for eastern North Carolina. Knowing what to do if you're in a rip current can save your life. For a visual aid on spotting rip currents and more safety tips, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The Beaufort Old Homes and Gardens Tour and Antique Show and Sale takes place next weekend. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the events, which includes a walking tour featuring private homes, gardens, churches, and historic buildings, as well as narrated bus tours of the historic district, concerts, and an antique car show. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the executive director of the Beaufort Historic Site, Patricia Suggs, about the event.
Perhaps one of the highlights of this event every year are the private homes that will be open to the public. Can you tell me about some of the featured homes this year?
I think this year we have some of the best homes we've ever had, and I've been here almost 20 years. It's such a variety with old historic homes and especially the Hammock House, which is one of everyone's favorite houses. It hasn't been on the tour in years. It's the one with all the legends about Blackbeard, that they say that Blackbeard supposedly visited this house when he was here. You know, they say there's blood on the stairs when someone died there. I mean, there's just so many stories, and it may be all folklore, but it's just fascinating stories about the house. So it's a true spectrum of all the history of Beaufort, with older historic houses as well as some new exquisite Front Street homes that are brand new.
Now, in addition to historic homes and gardens, there are a number of churches to see on the tour. What churches are available to see this year?
Well, we have St. Paul's Episcopal Church, the First Baptist Church, Ann Street Methodist Church, and then the oldest church in town is Purvis Chapel.
Where does the walking tour of the homes and gardens begin and end?
Well, the easiest thing for our visitors is to come to our historic site and our welcome center, which is in the 100 block of Turner Street in downtown Beaufort. But if they purchase their tickets in advance, they'll have a map and they can start at any one of the over 37 stops on the tour.
How long, in a physical sense, does the walking tour last?
What people normally do is take it at their leisure so they can do a few homes, a few gardens, go eat lunch, go back and do more. So you can do it self-paced. You can do it in 2 or 3 hours, or you can do some on Friday and then come back and do more on Saturday.
Let's shift gears for a moment from the home and garden shows to the antique show and sale that's going to be over at the Morehead City Civic Center.
We have over 40 different booths of antique dealers with things from vintage jewelry, old maps, to new this year. We have a person that has old vintage radios that he's redone the inside so they're Bluetooth capable, but yet they have the old look.
Is there anything that you have seen at the antique show and sale that looks rather unusual and that people who are looking for unusual things can possibly find?
Oh, my gosh. There's everything. We've got dealers that I don't know where they find everything, but they've got it. And even this year, we have a 5 feet long by 3 feet tall Confederate warship, Alabama. And it's a model of it that will be there for show and sale.
Wow, that's interesting. I believe that's the ship that was built in England and never made it back to the United States.
Right, that's right. And also this year, we're really excited. We have 3 tiny homes. They're park model tiny homes, so you can take your tiny home with you. And we've got local interior decorators that are putting new decor, and then they are combining with an antique show dealer to have antique period pieces with old and new mixed together. And what we're trying to do is show younger people, well, everyone, but especially the younger generation, that you don't have to throw out your parents and grandparents' antiques that have been in the family forever. You can combine them into making a beautiful space for your home.
What time does everything begin on that Friday through Sunday, I guess?
Right. So the private homes are open from 10 to 5, both Friday and Saturday. And then the antique show is 10 to 6 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, and then 10 to 4 on Sunday. So it gives you plenty of time to do both the old home store and the antique show.
Thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
It's a great weekend, so hope to see you there.
If you need more information about the 57th Annual Beaufort Old Homes and Gardens Tour and Antique Show, be sure to check out the events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
This is the Down East Journal. More drones are flying in North Carolina skies, and that's leading to more close encounters with aircraft, like 2 last week over Charlotte. One involved a police helicopter, the other an American Airlines jet. The problem, authorities say, is many operators don't know the law. WFAE's David Borax reports.
That's a Phantom, a small remote-controlled flying vehicle that carries a camera. All drones like this are supposed to be registered with the Federal Aviation Administration, and in some cases with the state, too. But many owners don't bother. That registration process includes tutorials and, in some cases, a test. So many never learn the rules, says Sergeant Kenneth Anderson, who oversees Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department's helicopters.
Most of it right now, we're finding, is just a lack of information or a lack of knowledge from those who are operating the drones. And if we can help close that gap between the knowledge and the operation of it, that would be a great safety improvement.
It's illegal to fly a drone over 400 feet at night or within 5 miles of an airport. But last Friday, an American Airlines jet preparing to land spotted a drone about a mile and a half from Charlotte Douglas Airport. And then there was that CMPD helicopter incident June 7th. It was near Charlotte Knights Stadium during a game.
It would have been a catastrophic incident had it struck the windshield of the helicopter.
These stories aren't unique to Charlotte. Commercial photographer Patrick Schneider of Huntersville has both federal and state drone licenses.
The problem stems from the fact that you can walk into any Best Buy anywhere and you can buy a $1,000 drone and put it in the air without any need to understand the rules.
More than 20,000 drones are registered with the FAA in the state, both hobbyists and commercial users. And 16 months ago, North Carolina began requiring commercial and government drone operators to get state permits, too. As of May 31st, only about 1,300 people had done so. The rules are stricter for commercial operators than for hobbyists. For example, you'd need state and federal commercial licenses if you're using a drone to photograph real estate for a sales website. Schneider says he's met photographers who try to skirt the rules.
There's a lot of people hiding behind, oh, I'm just a hobbyist, because the rules are very different if you call yourself a hobbyist as opposed to a commercial drone operator.
The federal and state laws have different aims, says Basil Yap of NCDOT's Aviation Division.
The federal government has sole sovereignty over the airspace above North Carolina. The North Carolina laws govern how those aircraft may interact with people on the ground. And what they're doing is protecting the privacy as well as the safety of individuals on the ground.
For example, you can be fined in North Carolina for taking a drone photo of somebody in a private place without their permission, like through an apartment window. It's also illegal to hunt or fish or attach a weapon to a drone. Yap says the state needs to spread the word about the law.
We understand that we need to continue to educate drone users in North Carolina about these North Carolina-specific laws and make them aware of these privacy and property protections that are in place.
That's about all they can do for now. The FAA and local police compile reports of illegal drones based on tips from pilots and citizens, but tracking down operators is hard and penalties are rare. Mostly, safety depends on drone operators. Apart from learning the rules, authorities say the easiest way to stay on the right side of the law is the FAA's Before You Fly app. It has rules and restrictions for wherever you're planning to fly. I'm David Borax in Charlotte.
Dancing, singing, and drumming. John Canoe is a long-celebrated African-American tradition. Its roots can be traced back to the 1800s in Jamaica and to the people of West Africa. This cultural practice is being preserved and taught this summer at Tryon Palace with free workshops every Tuesday from June 20th through August 8th. Here's an audio postcard from last year's event.
The purpose of the workshop is for the kids to understand what John Canoe means, the purpose of John Canoe, after they have worked the whole year, 365 days, harvest season, bringing in and making money for the masters. So what he would do is allow them one day, which was Christmas time, to be able to celebrate birthdays, weddings, someone's death, or whatever holiday it was that they did not get to celebrate. So they can let out some of their sting or some of their anger by just celebrating and having a great time.
I think it's a part of history that we can tell. It's, for me, it's not one of anything negative, but positive, because it speaks to a time when everybody is equal, when you can go on the master's front porch and shake his hand, dress up in the best clothing that you have, and just go about celebrating and doing the things that you are accustomed to.
particular drums that I have are three different types of djembes. Right there you have the double djembe, we have tambourines, we have, you know, different bells.
We have a young lady here. She is of African descent, and she loves coming on Tuesdays. You know, for her, she loves it. She's like, it's like home, you know. So, and that's beautiful, because that's what it's about. You know, whether the Boys and Girls Club, Jean Canoe, it's them finding something that feels like home to them.
Anybody is involved in this workshop. It is free to anyone that want to participate, whether they black, white, blue, purple, or green. We take anybody from the age of 5 years old to the age of 99.
It's an energy that really can't be described. Sort of just like you would do, in a drum circle, if you're familiar with the drum circle, where everybody is playing their beat. And once you get this high pitch or this energy or this spirit, it elevates everyone. And that's the way it does in Jean Canoe.
Jean Canoe performances are held throughout the year for educational programs, parades, and two Saturdays in December during candlelight at Tryon Palace. The workshop will be held Tuesdays at 3 p.m. from June 20th through August 8th. For more information, go to the ENC events page at publicradioeast.org.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I love my coffee, and we generate a significant quantity of coffee grounds in my house, so it was only a matter of time before I started researching how I could best utilize coffee grounds in the garden. Many people, myself included, add coffee grounds to their compost pile, but increasingly, people are using them straight up as a mulch around plants, claiming that they repel cats, kill slugs, prevent weeds, aerify and acidify the soil. The list goes on. So let's look a little bit at what we do know about coffee grounds. First of all, the phenolic compounds in aromatic essential oils that give coffee its flavor are reported to have antioxidant and antimicrobial properties. And in fact, some laboratory studies have shown that coffee grounds have the potential to suppress diseases as they decompose. In these studies, coffee grounds were used as part of a potting mix, and it's suspected that the bacteria and fungi that are normally found on coffee beans help to prevent pathogenic fungi from establishing, a little bit like giving your planting mix a good probiotic. So far, this disease suppression has only been demonstrated under controlled conditions on a limited number of crops. The efficacy of coffee grounds in suppressing disease in the garden or landscape is unknown, but it sounds like it couldn't hurt. Coffee grounds are also a relatively good source of nitrogen for the compost pile. Coffee is rich in protein, which is a source of nitrogen. In fact, the carbon to nitrogen ratio of coffee grounds typically starts out a little high at 25 parts of carbon for each part of nitrogen, but after composting, it can be as low as 11 to 1, an ideal ratio for plant and soil nutrition. Some people are concerned that coffee may acidify the soil. Some studies have shown that coffee grounds are acidic, while others show that composted coffee grounds can have a pH closer to neutral or even slightly alkaline. Another study showed that coffee can initially increase soil pH, followed by a gradual decrease. So what we can take away from all of this is that the pH of decomposing coffee grounds is not stable, and we shouldn't assume that it will always be acidic. So obviously there's more research that needs to be done, but there are some general recommendations that you should follow if you want to use coffee grounds in your garden. First, coffee grounds should not comprise more than 10 to 20% of your total compost pile by volume. While some coffee grounds are good, too many grounds can actually disrupt the structure of the pile and be detrimental. If you're using coffee grounds as a mulch, remember that they're finely textured and easily compacted. You'll want to apply no more than a half an inch of coffee grounds to the soil surface, and then cover them with 3 to 4 inches of a coarse organic mulch like hardwood or pine bark mulch. Too many coffee grounds could inhibit the movement of water into the soil. So brew yourself a nice cup of coffee and toss the grounds out in the garden or compost pile.